Trade Your Heart for Bones to Know, written by Black Cat and read by Flower Parish. This is a Star Wars fic, rated explicit, in which no archive warnings apply. It features the relationship Jaster Mareel / John Antilles. Summary: a week after an attack that nearly killed him and his son, Jaster Mareel finds Montross dead on a battlefield. His killer is a Jedi, grievously wounded, who Jaster takes into his care. By Mandalorian tradition, John Antilles owes him a life debt, and Jaster is cunning enough not to let such a thing slip away. It's meant to be an entirely political arrangement. It doesn't stay that way for long.
Know that you feel me somehow. You're the closest to heaven that I'll ever be, and I don't wanna go home right now. And all I could taste is this moment, and all I can breathe is your life. And sooner or later it's over. I just don't want.
Chapter 1. Jaster finds the Jedi in the middle of a field of bodies, Montross two halves of a corpse beside him. There's no one else around for miles, just dead Death Watch soldiers, dead traitors, and one Jedi who's miraculously still breathing. For a long moment, Jaster stays where he is, studying the scene. He's not quite sure how to feel, because Montross was his to kill, and every Mandalorian knew of Jaster's claim. But Montross was also dangerous, was gathering allies, knew too much. His treachery almost killed Jaster once already, almost killed Jango, and Jaster isn't about to question the gift of his enemies doing away with each other. Except they didn't, because the Jedi is still alive. He stirs faintly when Jaster presses a boot under him, but the movement is sluggish, not a threat. Satisfied, Jaster shoves him over onto his back, watching the deep hood fall away. A human Jedi, not much older than Jango, with dark hair and a scarred face, dressed in dark colors, and he groans a little, lashes fluttering but not rising. His breaths are weak, wet, and there's blood around his mouth. A blaster wound obvious in his gut. It's closing as Jaster watches, though slowly, and he looks from the hand the Jedi has pressed to his stomach up to that blood-splattered face, and makes a decision. Jedi are the enemy, but they weren't always. They aren't always. And given the number of bodies on the field, the way Montross was bisected, the way his favorite blaster is in two pieces at his feet, like the Jedi took the shot to the gut in order to get close enough to make the kill, Jaster is willing to say that this Jedi is a bit more like a Mandalorian than most of his kind. "Still alive, Jedi?" he asks, pulling off a gauntlet to press his fingertips to the Jedi's throat. There's a pulse, and it's thready, but not immediately deadly, given the way he's healing himself. He'll be healed before he runs out of blood, most likely, or at least enough so to survive the night. This planet gets cold, though, and there's a snowstorm coming. If he has to lie out in that for hours, hypothermia will take him before the gut wound can. There's a pause, and then, like it takes effort, the Jedi's eyes slide open, blink. They're pale blue, vague with pain and blood loss, but after a long, long moment, they fix on Jaster, manage to focus. The Jedi breathes out, a cloud of white on the wind, and then his eyes fall closed again. "Mandalore," he gets out, rasping, rough. "I took your vengeance. Apologies." Jaster pauses, startled, and looks him over again. Rough robes, patched tunics, and there's a hole in his left boot. Not the highly polished diplomat Jaster is used to in one of his order, certainly, or even one of the stuffy scholars Jaster spent so much time trying to pry old documents out of. A poor specimen, except for the fact that he's clearly more skilled than most Jedi, to have survived an attack against a whole battalion of the Death Watch. Except for the fact that he knows Jaster had claimed Montross's death, and respects the claim enough to offer an apology for subverting it. By true Mandalorian code, you forfeit your life to me by acknowledging that, Jaster says mildly, and pulls off his helmet, setting it in the snow beside him, regardless of whether you're a Mandalorian or not. The Jedi's mouth curves, quietly rueful, and he lifts his hand. His tunics are drenched in blood, black with it, but in the fading daylight, Jaster can see not one blaster wound, but three, clustered tight together in his gut. Not much life, he manages, and turns his head as he coughs, body convulsing. Blood spills from his lips, and Jaster watches him struggle to breathe, to stay conscious. Doesn't move, but... If you did live, he says, finally reaching out to pull the Jedi's head back towards him. Would you honor the debt? Montross was mine to kill, and you stole my revenge for the wounding of my son. Sorry, the Jedi breathes, like he's losing the thread of the conversation. Jaster tightens his grip on his chin, shaking him lightly, and with obvious effort, those pale eyes focus on him again. Jedi, answer me, Jaster says sharply, and the Jedi grimaces, but dips his head. I honor it, he gets out, and Jaster lets him go, satisfied. Stealing a death like Montress's would be an outrage without compare for any true Mandalorian, and not just because of who spoke for his death. Jaster is the Mandalore, but Montress almost killed Jango with his desertion, with his betrayal. And then, just a handful of days ago, he made another attempt, and this one almost succeeded. If Arla hadn't come upon the scene with a medic bare moments after it happened, Jango would be dead instead of just confined to a biobed for the near future. Montress's life was Jaster's to take, and while Jaster is practical enough not to regret the fact that he's dead at all, the loss of vengeance stings. Practicality has other uses too, though. There is a gift laid out at Jaster's feet, a Jedi alone and dying, his life now Jaster's. Once, in the past, a Mandalorian might have just executed him outright for the insult and been done with it. But Jaster is cleverer than that. One Jedi's existence will carry little weight when brought to bear against the Senate, but the Order is another matter entirely. A knight on their own, capable of what this man accomplished, is a valuable resource, and Jaster hadn't thought he would ever have enough leverage to treat with the Jedi directly, but this might just be what he needs. Amusing that Montress's betrayal could bring the true Mandalorians the one thing that will finally solidify them as the true rulers of Mandalore. And, well, it must have been a good fight, looking at the scene that's left. Montress was a danger, and the Jedi put him down, and he's shivering in the snow in patched robes and worn-out boots, entirely alone. Jaster is the Mandalore, but he has a heart as well. Especially for fighters. Good, Jaster says, and leans down. The Jedi watches him, wary but resigned, and when Jaster raises his hand, the Jedi flinches, closing his eyes like he's expecting a blow. Jaster doesn't hit him. He strokes tangled dark hair out of the Jedi's face, smiles a little at the startled look. You fought well, he says, and those pale eyes widen. The Jedi hesitates, like he's not sure what to do with that, and Jaster takes one bloody hand, pulls it up around his neck. Hold on to me, he says, and gets the Jedi's other arm up, then slides his own arm beneath the Jedi's knees. As gently as he's able, he eases the Jedi up, one arm around his back, and grimaces a little at the choked-off cry of pain. Shh, he soothes, and rises, hauling the young man up as he gets his feet under him. There's a gasp, fingers gone claw tight on his shoulders, and a strangled sob, but Jaster gets him up and holds him there for a long moment. Slowly, gradually, those trembling, hitching breaths even out, and the Jedi presses his face into Jaster's shoulder, pale and shaking, but still conscious. That's impressive enough all on its own, and Jaster keeps his steps as light as possible as he turns back toward his ship and activates his comm. "Sir?" Miles answers instantly, tone tight, and Jaster snorts. "There are only corpses down here," he says. "I'm in no danger, Miles." Slowly, Miles lets out a breath. "Montress?" he asks. "Also dead," Jaster answers. "Have the medical wing standing by for my arrival. Montress's killer is still with us, if only barely." There's a long pause, and then Miles asks, "You don't just want to execute him?" Jaster glances down at the Jedi, bleeding out in his arms but still clinging to awareness. His eyes are on Jaster, wary as a wild animal in a trap, and Jaster smiles, just a little. "No," he says. "I think I would very much like him in one piece." "They'll be waiting, sir," Miles answers. "Anything else?" Jaster glances back towards the battlefield as he reaches the top of the hill. There are native carrion birds already beginning to circle, and even if he personally finds the Death Watch's beliefs repugnant and worthy of condemnation, they're dead. They're dead, and they were Mandalorians, and they believed in what they fought for. He can honor that. "Find volunteers to help build a pyre," he says, "and to gather the bodies for it. All except Montress. His soul can rot in nothingness forever for what he planned for my family." The Jedi stares back at him for one long, fraught second, then exhales. His eyes slide closed, and Jaster watches him breathe, shallow but unfaltering, all the way back to the shuttle. It's a little like finding a kyber crystal in the mud, Jaster thinks, lowering the Jedi into the co-pilot's seat as gently as he can. The young man is unconscious, and he doesn't stir when Jaster tucks his hair behind one ear, assesses his scars. Deep and old, most of them, but there are new ones as well, and Jaster brushes the backs of his fingers over them, thoughtful and a touch curious. He has a face that isn't quite pretty, even without the scars, but it's certainly arresting. Thoughts for another time, Jaster decides, and starts the ship's engines. The Jedi will survive until they're back on the main ship, and then... well, several dozen plans that Jaster had previously dismissed as unworkable are suddenly astonishingly feasible, and a traitor to his cause is dead. It's been quite the productive day, if entirely unexpected. It's warm. It takes John a long moment, long stretch of minutes, to realize why this is strange. He's buried in heat, in soft blankets, with a surface beneath him that's softer than anything he's ever slept on before, and the world is quiet except for the distant hum of mines. It's peaceful, and there's no sense of threat anywhere within range of his senses. John curls deeper into the warmth, feeling real fur against his bare skin, and doesn't want to open his eyes. Whatever sort of dream this is, whatever near-death hallucination it is, brought on by cold and blood loss and exhaustion, he doesn't want it to end. And then, like a shock of cold water, he remembers why he was bleeding out, and his breath hitches. He jerks up, alarm ringing through him, and stops, because he's not on a battlefield, and even though he's awake, there's no doubt that the warmth is real. He's in a large bed, piled with blankets, and the room around him is lit by a fire in the wide hearth, the regular lights kept low. A lamp illuminates the corner of the room with tall, deep bookshelves lining the walls, a comfortable chair right beneath the light. Wide windows look out on a darkened field, a pair of full moons in the sky. It's nowhere John has ever seen before, and he sits up fully, clutching one of the thicker furs and trying to remember what happened. He'd heard, while undercover as a smuggler, that one of the true Mandalorian's declared enemies had been seen, that they were staging a raid on a nearby world very soon. Jedi are discouraged from getting involved in Mandalorian politics, but Jon hadn't been able to stomach the idea of so many lives lost, so he just left. Left the mission, left the smuggler's crew, and hunted Montross down, even knowing that the Mandalore had claimed the bastard's life. If the Mandalore had been there, Jon would gladly have let him kill Montross, but Jon was the one available, and Montross wasn't going to let one setback stop him from killing more innocents. Even knowing there was a vendetta on Montross's head, a claim any Mandalorian would kill Jon for subverting, he'd known the risk of Montross getting away was too great. Jon is a Jedi. No matter the personal cost, he had to stop the threat. So he did. And then, awake, a voice asks, and Jon stiffens, then raises his head to find a figure leaning in the doorway. The Mandalore watches him in return, and Jon has never seen hollows of Jaster Mereel without his helmet on, but there's still no doubting who he is, just like there was no doubting it when he found Jon on the battlefield. Would you honor the debt? Montross was mine to kill, and you stole my revenge for the wounding of my son. I honor it. He means it still. Even if he's not dying right now, Jon will keep his word, because he gave it, because Jedi honor their promises. He has no idea what Jaster wants with him, no expectation that it will be anything good when the Jedi and Mandalorians are enemies, but he knowingly killed Montross, acknowledging all of the potential consequences. This was one of them. Yes, he says quietly, and the words are rough, his throat dry. He pulls the blankets a little more tightly around himself, not sure what to say. Not sure what all this is for, or why Jaster carried him off the battlefield when he was so clearly dying anyway. Good, Jaster says, and approaches the bed with measured steps. Lie back. The medics are confident you won't die, but I'm supposed to apply Bacta to the wound as often as possible. Jon presses a hand to his stomach in surprise, and the skin is tender, but there's no scar. Someone used a dermal mender on him, with skill and in enough time not to leave scar tissue, and Jon had thought it was just his own healing working, slow and rough, but... Lie back, Jaster says again, and Jon swallows, but does as he's told. With an approving sound, Jaster picks up a small tub of Bacta from the floor, then sits down on the edge of the bed, unscrewing the top. You managed to find Montross and his Death Watch cell when none of my contacts could, he says, and Jon wants to twitch away from the look in his dark eyes. An impressive feat. Jon swallows, still not sure what to do with any of this. If Jaster wants to execute him for stealing a kill that was rightfully his, healing him seems counterproductive. I was undercover, he says, with the Firehand Gang. They were supplying some of the Death Watch's weapons, and a contact warned them Montross was about to stage a raid on a planet where they sometimes did business. I couldn't let him get that far. Jaster studies him for a long moment, like he's weighing Jon's words, and then inclines his head. The Firehand, he repeats, a touch grim. I hadn't heard they had ties to the Death Watch, but given their reputation, it's unsurprising. The idea of giving Jaster the Order's information on any of this shouldn't sit right, and Jon hesitates, but the true Mandalorians are just as opposed to the Death Watch and their tactics as the Order is, if not more so, and Jon would rather pass on the information to Jaster than have it sit in waiting as the Council deals with 1,000 other matters that are of more immediate concern. The Order is always stretched thin, and the Outer Rim has fewer people, fewer senators petitioning for assistance. It's understandable that resources turn towards the Core Worlds and the Inner Rim, but Jon has never had much patience for such things. The Outer Rim is where he operates, and he won't turn his back on it, even if that means relying on the Jedi's traditional enemies. There's a network, he says, I was trying to follow all the threads and find the person organizing them, but I haven't yet. Jaster lays a hand over his stomach. John flinches automatically, tensing, braced for the sharp, abrasive slash of Dark Woman's healing. Even 10 years out from being her Padawan, his body still expects the healing, and the lesson of having to be healed to hurt just as much as the original wound. Shh, Jaster soothes, and his touch is gentle as he eases the blanket down, his fingers light as they feel out the edges of the wound. Only Bacta, you look as though you haven't seen enough of it in your life. The scars. John closes his eyes, because it's the only way he can hide right now, but he wants his cloak, his hood, something to hide him from Jaster's gaze. It doesn't matter if he picks up scars during a mission, but in the aftermath, when people have to look at him, it starts to matter far more. And John doesn't regret them, but he regrets the reaction they cause, the way they make him look. The reminder they pose, because if John had been a better student, if he'd had the same skill that Dark Woman did, a hand catches his chin, gently but firmly pulling him back to face Jaster. You've lived a warrior's life, Jaster says, and when John opens his eyes, startled, Jaster lets go, smoothing his fingers over John's hair. The map of it stays on your skin, as it should. There's no response John can make, no translating the tangle of emotion in his chest into words. Instead, he drops his eyes as much as he can and says, "My comm. There are notes about the Firehand gang and their contacts. I haven't figured out which link to the Death Watch yet, but..." Jaster's hand covers his forehead, one light touch to hold him still. "You need to rest before you do anything else," Jaster says, and John stops, almost bewildered by the words. This is concerning Jaster's enemies, terrorists trying to destroy his people. John had thought, "You were shot 6 times, by my medic's count," Jaster says, amused, and his other hand gently strokes the Bacta across John's stomach. John twitches, but there's no avoiding the touch, and the Bacta soothes the ache he hadn't even realized was creeping up on him. He breathes out, closing his eyes, and Jaster hums quietly. "You're on Concord Dawn," he says, and his voice is low. It makes John want to shiver, and between the tone and the soft touch, he feels caught. Out of his depth, with the bed beneath him and furs around him, and Jaster leaning over him, still watching. Tor Vizsla staged an attack on my main compound on Mandalore, so this seemed a safe alternative. As far as I'm aware, he doesn't know of its existence, so we have some time to regroup. We. Because John's life belongs to the Mandalore now. John swallows, but manages, "No one nearby intends harm." There's a pause, Jaster's hand stilling against his skin, and Jaster makes a quiet sound of amusement. "Jedi premonitions?" "No," John says honestly, and opens his eyes to look up at him. "The people here, all I feel from them is concern for you." Jaster is silent for a long moment before he finally smiles, just faintly. "The Death Watch is full of thugs," he says, "and criminals looking for an excuse to hurt others. But the true Mandalorians will outlast them." Leaning forward, he smooths more Bacta over a blaster graze across John's shoulder, and John flinches despite himself, closing his eyes again. The brush of fingers in his hair comes as a surprise, and John startles, but the hand just drags overly long strands out of his eyes and tucks them back. "You were unconscious for almost 3 days, Jaster says, his voice still that same low, soothing cadence. "But the medics say that you should be well enough to put your feet on the ground by tomorrow. Until then, rest." John curls his fingers into the blankets. "I need to find them," he manages. "The Death Watch. If I keep following the suppliers..." There's a quiet snort. "My people have been looking for the Death Watch's main base for a very long time now, since well before Montross betrayed us," he counters. "One Jedi in the fray will change very little. You have more than enough time to heal, and then we can discuss what you know." A pause, and then Jaster says, "Your health will be far more of an asset to me than your efforts while half-dead, Jedi." Before John can answer, there's a rap at the door. "Mandalore," a voice calls through it. "Django is awake and asking for you." John watches the relief rise in Jaster's face, the way he pushes to his feet automatically, then pauses. He glances back at John and says, pitch to Carrie, "I'll be right there, thank you." "Yes, sir." Steps move away from the door, and in their wake, Jaster leans down and pulls the blanket back up over John's chest. "I may be gone a few hours," he says. "Sleep if you can, and we'll speak later." John nods, and Jaster appraises him for another moment, then asks, "Your name, Jedi?" Startled, John blinks. He hadn't realized that he'd failed to give it. "John," he says, "John Antilles." Jaster's brows rise faintly, and John grimaces, knowing where his thoughts are going. "It's the only one I have to give." Amusement touches the curve of Jaster's mouth. "Then it's the one I'll take," he says, and leans over. The lift of his hand makes John flinch, never good with things near his face, but there's no blow. Knuckles skim across a scar, fingers tuck his hair back behind his ear, and Jaster straightens again. "Later," he says, a promise, and leaves the room with long strides, the doors sliding shut behind him with a soft hiss. For a long, long moment, John lies where he is, not quite able to breathe for reasons unrelated to the blaster wounds in his stomach. His cheek burns where Jaster touched him, and he sits up slowly, pulling his knees to his chest, regardless of how it makes the wound pull unpleasantly. There's an ache somewhere in his chest that has nothing to do with wounds, and he closes his eyes, presses his face into his knees, and tries to remember how to breathe. He should get up, keep moving, find his comm, contact the Order, let them know that him dropping out of his mission in the middle was for a reason. Should contact Dark Woman and let her know about the Firehand Gang, since she was the one who pointed him to them to begin with. She might have more information, though she won't give it up gladly, particularly if she knows he intends to offer it to the true Mandalorians. But she doesn't need to know. John learned a very long time ago that telling her anything but what she wanted to hear was never going to end well. He drags a hand through his hair, grimacing at the stiffness of dried blood in the strands, the pull of a new scar that he did manage to heal before Montress shot him. A fresher would be a good idea, but his body aches, and the idea of standing is unpleasant. All the things he should be doing feel unimportant in the face of the knowledge that he's promised his life away to a Mandalorian. Not just a Mandalorian, but the Mandalore, the man who's managed the nearly impossible task of uniting the majority of Mandalore's clans behind him. He's powerful. He's one of the Order's traditional enemies, too, and John has no idea what he even wants. It's not hubris for John to know that he himself is a powerful Jedi. He isn't what Dark Woman wanted him to be, but she made sure he was strong, dangerous. If Jaster wants John to fight for him, demands he honor his debt with service on the battlefield, John will have to decide where the lines fall, what he can do as a Jedi, as someone with a life debt. And it won't control him. He won't let himself be forced into evil things. But the idea that he might do things that go against the Order, that's a less clear line. There's little doubt that Jaster will want him to fight. It's what John is good at, and Jaster said he'd lived a warrior's life. Why remark on it if it wasn't something he wanted to take advantage of? With a rasping breath, John slides out of the bed, stumbles as his feet hit the floor, and almost falls. He's naked, and the air is bitingly cold, but after a second to breathe and control the pain, John drags one of the blankets off the bed, wraps it around himself. The urge to lie down and sleep is there, but restlessness prickles under John's skin, digs claws into his spine that the ache in his stomach and chest can't block out. Healing himself will have to wait until he's stronger, but in the meantime, just laying down and waiting for whatever fight Jaster will send him into isn't something John can do. He needs something. 3 steps across the cold floor has his vision spinning, though, and John makes it to the chair in the corner and decides that's far enough. He sinks into it with a groan, because there's no one around to hear, and curls up there for a moment, trying to get his breath back. It's still quiet. There are a handful of minds moving, a handful of people awake, and John can sense the low thrum of overall contentment that's like a balm on frayed nerves. Closing his eyes, he matches his breathing to the pulse of it, settles back in the chair, and draws his legs up, pulls the blanket more tightly around himself. A sharp lance of pain makes him hiss, makes him take another moment to brace himself through it, but the bed is too soft. John can't lie there waiting for something to happen. Making it 5 meters away won't do much in the long run, but it's something, and John can read if he needs to, can distract himself, and not think about what he swore, and how he really does mean it, even now. Jaster Muriel doesn't feel like an evil man. He smiled when John said his people loved him, and felt warm. The care for his son is obvious, too. John has met men who were far worse than Jaster with far less reason. He just doesn't know how it will apply to him, and the thought of finding out makes it a little hard to breathe. Or maybe, John thinks ruefully, dropping his head back against the chair. That's the blaster wound in his stomach. Sometimes it's just hard to tell. End of chapter 1.